Welcome, everyone, to East Meets West, episode 241. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And we are back live streaming our show on the Twit Network for the first time in a couple of weeks. How does it feel, Roger?
It feels good. I mean, I know our schedules have been somewhat hectic and illness and all that stuff. So it's good to be kind of back on the tracks, as it were.
Back on schedule for schedule, East Meets West.
Schedule.
Still don't have any sponsors, though. I've given up. I don't think we'll ever have sponsors again. I think we were lucky to fool people for a short period of time that to sponsor us, and then that's it.
You know, maybe we'll find someone who's, the Commonwealth Club. We could have them sponsor us.
I think you think we could fool the Commonwealth Club into spending some money for a short period of time.
Maybe it could be part of their public outreach program. I don't know.
We've struggled with whether to actually define East Meets West or not. When we very first started the show in 2005, there was intentionally no definition. It was open to just me and Roger talking about whatever. And then at some point we decided to make it commentary about culture to sort of not so much define the show for us, but to explain it to people, because that seems to be what we talk about. We talk about television shows. We talk about politics. We talk about issues of the day in all arenas. We talk about entertainment. But I think we should bill it as a talk show.
Why not? It is a talk show.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've ever shied away from describing it as a talk show. I think we've shied away from describing the content.
Yeah.
The subject matter.
That's the brilliance of a talk show, right? I mean, you think about any of these Late Night with David Letterman, or Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, Late Show with David Letterman, or even the afternoon talk shows. They don't define their content. They just talk. Although they have guests.
Yes.
We'd have to have guests more often.
And they tend to start with a monologue, usually incorporating
some
sort
of... that? Should we start starting with a monologue?
I don't know. There's two of us. It'd be kind of weird.
Duologue?
I could be the Ed McMahon, like the guy behind.
Hey, yep. Tommy. I like that. We should do a duologue. We could break new ground. Alternate jokes.
We could start off. Oh, I don't have any jokes lined up though.
Well, we need writers.
It's true, but we need good writers.
We could just start having more guests on, and then call it a talk
show. I think that's
one of our
greatest strengths is to attract a wide variety of guests.
I think our best shows are with guests. Not denigrating either one of us, but it always adds that
you
new
mean denigrating
element.
Me.
I don't mean to denigrate just me, but also you. No, I mean it just when you're it's like a marriage, Roger. You know,
you
need to invite some other people in to keep it interesting. Wait.
Oh, that kind of marriage.
That metaphor broke down.
I don't know. Eileen's in the same room with you, so you can judge by the expression on her face.
I did not hear a laughter. That tells you anything.
So, I mean, we could cover the news. I mean, Egypt has been in the news forever, so I'm not sure if people want us to...
Well, okay, here's what's interesting to me, right? So Tunisia started this all off.
Yes.
And then their leader fell, and now Egypt's leader, Hosni Mubarak, has stepped down. That country is now in transition. The military is in charge. It's interesting to see which way it's going to go. There have been protests in Yemen all the way through this, but after the success of the Egyptian movement in getting President Mubarak to step down, people were starting to predict that there was going to be a wave of revolutions. And in fact, this weekend, protests were planned in Algeria, as well as Yemen. But it's unclear whether those protests were successful or not. They certainly weren't as successful as Egypt's had been. Although some people are arguing that they may be more similar to what happened in Tunisia, where they get run off by the police. In fact, in Algeria, the police outnumbered the protesters. But they show that it's possible to put out a protest, and then they come back with a bigger protest later.
I don't know. I mean, there are many different models that could go. They could go with they could do the one that was, you know, the green revolution, the wave in Iran, which, I mean, it didn't peter out, but it did have to go underground. I mean, the authorities were successful enough to put a clamp down or at least a lid on it, and many of the protesters have had to kind of voice their opinions and views on everything through alternate channels, like the whole kind of taking over streets. While exciting to watch and really, if you were someone at home, you were thinking like, we're on the cusp of something huge here, didn't manifest itself in the way that a lot of people were expecting. Egypt is kind of in a critical period here. Yet Mubarak stepped down, but the levers of power have not transitioned over. So
Transitioned over, but I think what you mean is they haven't transitioned away from the establishment because they're now in the hands of the military, which was part of the establishment.
Exactly. It's too early to say. I think, these things are one of those things where you can't go day by day by day. I mean, it's literally you need to look at it in maybe in weeks or even months where you can kind of see things kind of manifest or develop in a way that you think will show that, okay, now a democratic government's gonna take control based on the will of the people, or this is just another transition from one organ of state to another, in this case from Mubarak's cabinet and himself to the military. Now, whether this means that, this is a transition that will eventually end up being a democratic country, who's to say? I mean, Turkey's had several military coups in the past, and, usually, relatively short time afterwards, the military handed power back to a civilian government. Will we see the same thing in Egypt? I don't know. I mean, in Egypt's history, you basically have military coup after one after another. I mean, Sadat, after he signed the peace deal with Israel, was killed in a military coup and military took power. So, Mubarak came from the Air Force. Are we going to see another military, general or whatever, step down from a military office just to hold a political office? Or are we going to see an actual transition where you're going to have, wide elections? Or are they going to be selected, selective elections? Some parties are included, other parties are not. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on. And I think it would be too early to say that, one thing is for sure. Is there a democratic wave? Maybe. Is there a definite uprising in, popular protests? Yes, but a lot of that was instigated due to high food prices, lack of jobs, a lot of things that, anyone else in the world can kind of sympathize with. Does it mean that they want a democratic model of government that, say, like Western Europe or the U.S. has? I don't know. But it does mean that those leaders will have to address those particular issues. I think if the leaders can essentially, address the high food prices, jobless issues, they could effectively co-opt the protest in a way where people aren't demanding for government change. But as long as they get, enough food to eat at a relatively cheap price and have jobs to work at, they won't be as angry.
I have to agree with you that we're going to have to wait to see what's really going to happen. I think it's certainly possible that there will be a wave of protests. I think it's almost inevitable that there will be a wave of protests in other countries. Dina in the chat room pointed out Syria as well as Yemen and Algeria. But I'm also unsure how much more success can be expected. I believe Tunisia, for sure, and to a large extent Egypt, suffered from underestimating the seriousness of the protests. And I don't think that's going to happen again in repressive regimes such as Algeria. I think they definitely have looked at these two and said, we're not taking any chances. We're going to put the police out in force. That said, it doesn't mean it's impossible for protesters to make a change and fight that down. It just means it could be more volatile, be bloodier than these other protests have been. I mean, one of the things about Egypt, as many people died, it was much lower in fatalities than you would have expected, given the kind of revolution it was.
Yeah, and ultimately, I mean, a lot of the opinions that commentators, editorials, pundits have put forth are based on, you know, the opinions of an educated group of people within those protests. And while, you know, a lot of them have also talked to like the Muslim Brotherhood and other political organizations that make up that protest, it's still, you know, it still remains to be seen if these opinions are in fact the opinions of the mass, you know, of a great deal, you know, of the population of Egypt. Do these views represent them, or are they just there because they too want to express their popular anger at a government they think has not delivered the services that they think were, you know, demanded by the population?
Yeah, it's going to take time, and it's going to be complicated. Yeah.
And you know, the thing is. You know, even after, say, Egypt makes a successful transition, it is a representative democracy that has each of the various, you know, views from the minorities as well as the majority of Egyptians in a Senate or in a parliamentary style government. They're still going to have to wrestle with the increasing cost of food, fuel, and of course, jobs. So, just because you suddenly have a new form of government doesn't mean all those issues go away. And if those issues aren't addressed, you could still see yet another uprising because people are angry. You know, I think we're angry at the fact that I can't buy food.
I think one of the things that you have to realize is they have discovered their power recently. And so, even if things get marginally better, there may be less patience for change than there was for 30 years when arguably things were worse, but there wasn't momentum towards stepping up and speaking out. Now that they've broken down that barrier, you often see societies, you know, demanding more than maybe is even reasonable. That doesn't mean it will happen, and that doesn't mean that this revolution is doomed in any, you know, I think you're being a little negative.
I'm not saying that it's doomed. However, I don't think this style of revolution will have a quick turnover into a government that I think is stable. I think, you know, I think of very few revolutions where it went off relatively well without a big period of civil disturbance where you have different, you know, sides jostling for control of government or at least to form a new government. And so, you know, I mean, if you look back at the American Revolution, I mean, one of the things people don't realize is there was an effective government already in place in the American colonies, ready to fulfill that role when when the breakaway from Great Britain took place. I mean, is there a transitory government right now in Egypt? I don't know. I mean, there's a military one, and has said certain things. Whether or not they'll follow through, I mean, it's a different matter.
We had some good responses on the website, sobrilliant.com/EMW, because we talked about this a little bit last week. Some of them are pretty long. But I'll try to excerpt from this. An anonymous poster said, the Bolsheviks were not the most popular group during the Russian Revolution, but they were the most organized and the most ruthless. I think that the Muslim Brotherhood are known as the most organized, and they gained 30% of the parliamentary seats in the last election, even while they were an illegal organization. And limited representation means that their power base is bigger than 30% of the population. I haven't checked those facts, so I'm not representing them that way, but that's the way our poster said it. I actually think that this is all about the lack of opportunities for young adults. The spark in Tunisia was a graduate that ended up trying to sell fruit to get money, but was stopped from doing so. This then led to him killing himself due to desperation. His story is not something out of the ordinary for young workers in the Middle East. The more I think about it, especially with the example of China, if the people had the opportunities, I think the protests would never have happened. What President Bush said and did really had nothing to do with the current situation, as it was something based on demographics and job growth. Can I point out one of the other momentous events was the result of the Sudanese referendum, which came out with 98.83% of the votes in southern Sudan voting for separation. I hope that against the history of civil wars, the transition will be peaceful.
Well, you know, it's interesting that he mentioned demographics, because one of the things that underpins a lot of these countries Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and most Middle East and North African countries, is that they have a huge population of young people. I mean, Egypt, the people like around 30 or under make up a bulk of the population. And what you have are people who are restless, who have the energy, who have the desire and the you know, maybe not the means, but definitely the force of personality to kind of do things, where you'll see these situations as populations get older. I'm not sure you'll have that same situation. One of the things that people mention about China's demographics is, you know, due to its one child policy, China will get, as a population, as a demographic, will be older before the country gets rich per capita. And so, you know, when that happens or doesn't happen, is there enough, you know, people who, you know, in their 40s or 50s who are going to go out, protest, throw things, set things on fire, or somehow, you know, set up a, you know, a revolutionary structure in the same way that young people would? I mean, it's kind of interesting. Most revolutions, although they might have older leaders, are generally supported by young people.
Well, they have more energy. Once you get our age, you don't really want to leave the house. It takes a lot to get you out in the streets. I'm not even kidding. Like, yeah, you know, it really is a young person's avocation to revolt.
And you know, one of the side things in Freakonomics was the mention that, you know, there was a dip in crime because at that time the number of young males was a lower percentage of the American population at any other time in recent history. So, you know, people can argue that young males without jobs tend to be more explosive, or at least a lot more virulent in their expressions of disgust, or at least opinion, than, say, someone twice their age. And so you have this kind of mix of young people, poor economic conditions, not enough jobs, people just angry, festering, and it just boils over. And especially when you have countries where, you know, a good chunk of it is, you know, around 30, you're probably going to see a lot more of those style, you know, protests than you would, say, like in Germany, where more people are older than young.
Paul Seven wrote on our blog at sabrilliant.com/EMW, "I don't see the military continuing the dictatorship. They are too intertwined with the people to not listen to them after all the protests. Their ranks are filled with conscripted Egyptians, and the military sell a lot of stuff to the people. If you haven't listened to it, check out NPR's Planet Money podcast. This means that Egypt will most likely have elections. The fear right now is that hardline Islamists will win the elections and take over the country. For them to win the elections and control Egypt, they must have a majority support. Is the U.S. afraid that the majority of people in Egypt support the hardline Islamists? I think this was what Tom was trying to get at. It doesn't seem like that is the case. But let's say that, in fact, the majority of people are hardline Islamists, and they got elected fair and square. Why is this bad if we believe in democracy?" asks Paul Seven. The people are not suppressed. They voted. That's how they feel. I think it does raise the question, is democracy always a good thing? I find it interesting how the U.S., we have this belief that democracy is always right and that the majority rules, when in fact the U.S. Constitution is written to protect against the tyranny of the majority. It was one of Madison's greatest fears.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting to say. I mean, you know, one of the arguments has always been that you know, democracies do not go to war to get, you know, against each other. But I mean, if you look at it, I mean, even the Greek states went at it. So, you know,
wait a minute. Were you trying to say that the Greek states warring are an example of democracies going to war against each other?
You know, no, you don't think so?
Well, no, because they weren't all democracies.
I know, but some of them weren't. They did. Well, it's.
I don't know that there's an example there of two democracies fighting each other. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, in any case, back to the nut of the question. Yeah, I mean, you can say that any country that has diverging interests, or at least conflicting interests, you'll have a point where people might come to blows, or at least countries will instigate some sort of police or military action in order to maintain, say, territorial sovereignty, economic ties with a mutual or at least, you know, group interest, say, like in an area that has oil and everyone says, "I have this, I have that," and things aren't discussed. I don't know. I think it could very well be. I mean, that's not to say that that's an argument against having a democratic a government, but I mean, it's something that should be put into consideration.
I don't think most people in the United States actually believe in democracy. I believe that most people think they believe in democracy. If you ask them, do you believe in democracy? They would answer yes. But I think that most people only believe in democracy when it supports something they already believe in. And I say that because of what Paul is pointing out here, that when democracy seems to lead to a result we don't like, suddenly we're not so sure if we like democracy anymore. And I posted on Twitter when Mubarak and when it was announced that Mubarak was stepping down and that power was being handed over to the defense minister, that it revealed that Egypt had never been a democracy, because rather than following the constitution, which would have given power to the speaker of parliament, they handed power to the military. They were dictators. And that was the last revelation of that. And I made the analogy that Mubarak handing power to the defense minister and therefore the military was akin to Barack Obama resigning from the presidency and handing power to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then I realized, well, actually, they handed it to the defense minister, so it would be more like handing it to Gates, the Secretary of Defense. Now, it didn't stun me, but what I found interesting was many people replying, because they don't like President Obama, I think that would be a great thing. I didn't engage in that, but I wanted to say, so you don't believe in democracy. You believe that we should just do whatever, you know, they're like, I think it'd be better to bypass Biden and give it to Gates. But that's not the way we set up the government. So you're essentially saying, I don't believe in following the rules when I disagree with the result of them. And I think that is true of democracy. I think we like to throw democracy around as something, as an ideal. I think we like to pretend. But whenever there's an argument within the United States even about, well, democracy would mean this, and that's not what we have, you see people saying, well, that's because we're a republic. We're not a democracy. So, you know, there isn't really a commitment to democracy, even though very often people laud it and raise it high and praise it it were this great ideal, but they really hypocritically don't follow it.
Yeah, it's because, you know, part of it is that there people will always have a divergent view on something with someone else. And when that comes to something, say, like taxes, people, you know, if you did, I mean, what would you describe as a purest form of democracy? Would it be, you know, absolute, like an absolute majority or like say 51% of voters say, you know, no new taxes? Does that mean those taxes should be implemented? Or do you believe that a representative democracy would be a better model?
Well,
the reason I ask is if we just had a situation where people would vote on every decision, say instead of handing it to legislators or something, say it's something like should cannabis be decriminalized, and you opened it up to every, you know, eligible voter in the United States and you just tallied individual votes and you did a pure majority wins on that. Would that be considered democracy or no?
Well, I see what you're saying, which is, you know, how do we define what is a democracy? That's a little different from the point I was trying to make, but it's worth exploring. I was trying to make the point that we say democracy is great. Democracy is the best. We should spread democracy through the world. Anyone who's not a democracy is not supporting freedom until it doesn't support our outcome. Now, what you're saying is a little different, which is, well, what is a democracy anyway? Well, because a direct democracy, a true democracy, would have every single citizen having to weigh in on every single decision. As we can see in California, where we have the proposition system, that has a lot of problems. We don't even have the citizens weighing in on every decision, but they have to weigh in on so many decisions that the legislature here is paralyzed in what they can do sometimes. We can talk about what level of democracy is the best, and what we have in the United States is arguably a representative democracy, but many people say it's not a democracy, it's a republic. There are democratic elements of it, but we are a republic, and therefore we shouldn't be supporting democracy. But those are the same people that will also stand up and praise our democracy and how we should spread democracy throughout the world.
And you know, ultimately, you know, it seems kind of self-interested to say, but I mean, you do what's in the best interest of your country or your national interest. I mean, that's how every country operates. No country will altruistically support something that's against its own best interest. I mean, that's just out of the question. I mean, no, I've yet to see an instance. Even countries that say give money out as aid or as aid in development do so because in the end it benefits them in the long run. Say you develop a country then where people are no longer at a subsistence level but are developing, building, and able, you know, developing an economy in which they're able to buy stuff. So you have a new market, you have, you know, one less part of the world that you might have, say, illegal immigrants or a trade in an illicit substance like drugs, or like what you have off the Horn of, you know, Africa, where you have pirates, you know, hijacking cargo ships. You know, it's if things could happen in a vacuum where that whatever happened over there didn't matter here, then people could, yeah, say, I stand up for certain values, la da 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 da. But as soon as you say that, well, you know what, if they do that, that means you're going to be screwed out of cheap oil or access to the Suez Canal, then suddenly people's like, oh, hold on there for a minute. You know, maybe it's not such a good idea. And what you have is people running into pragmatic issues as, you know, their idealism kind of splinters apart because they realize what it means.
Yeah, and you have people in the chat room right now saying, well, a republic is a kind of democracy or a subset of democracy. And there's very good arguments for that. I mean, a republic is a state without a dictatorial head. It is the reign of the public or a public affair, but it is different than democracy. If you go to the roots of it, democracy is a different kind of government than republic, although you can use elements of democracy because you elect representatives, perhaps. There's all different ways to set up a republic, and you can definitely put democracy under a republic and inject it with. That's what we've done in the United States, which is why we praise democracy here, and there's a culture of building it up. But I don't think that we think very much about what it means when we're talking about spreading democracy. There's also democracy in communism. Yes. There are elections, and there are elections with multiple candidates. Now, they can't not be members of the Communist Party, but they are elections, and there are sometimes multiple Communist Party candidates that are running against each other. That is democracy. So we're, you know, I don't want to make this too much of a relativistic argument, but, you know, I think maybe what I'm getting at is we should praise the actual traits we want to exist in a society over a particular way of getting to them. So freedom has its own problems in talking, but freedom seems to be something that's like, well, how you achieve freedom could be many different ways, but freedom from oppression, you know, freedom to decide your own affairs, you know, anti-dictatorship. Those are all things that are much easier to define and identify, I think.
And in the end, I mean, honestly, it's one of those things that, you know, you need to sit back and see what, you know, unfolds. Perhaps, you know, Egypt will find a relatively smooth way to move from, you know, what has been the government system for the past 30 years into something, you know, more reflective of the population wishes, you know. And I think so many people are so eager to project their particular idealism, their worldview on a situation because they want so earnestly to have that come true. It's like, you know, people power, you know, dictator's role is fall, and you know, this is an example of people's desire for freedom and equality, you know, above all else. I don't know. I think it's great. I think it's too soon. If the Egyptians manage to coalesce a government that is truly reflective and stable, then I think you know that great on them. They've done something really awesome. I am not holding my breath that it will happen in a way that won't result in more blood, you know, bloodshedding, or at least, you know, a lot of acrimony or intense words by various people. But I mean, I don't see it ending up like Iraq, where you have large sections of sectarian violence from one group to another in that regard. So, but that's my opinion.
You're pessimist.
Because I see the dark cloud and every silver lining.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I don't think it's all roses, and it's certainly not over in Egypt. But I do have a little more hope than you're expressing. I have a suspicion you have a little more hope than you're expressing too.
We'll see. I don't know. I mean, I used to be really, really optimistic about a lot of things, but maybe time has just worn me down.
You would vote for a pessimocracy.
Perhaps. Or I would call it more of a realist.
Realocracy?
Realocracy.
Realistocracy? See, sure. Now here's one of the things.
Why does it have to be a crisy? Maybe it's not by the people for the people. Maybe it's just by a subset of people.
I think we are heading very slowly, and I won't see it in my lifetime, towards a new form of government being implemented.
In the U.S.?
No, humanity. Because right now you've got dictatorships, and arguably communism is a dictatorship, but it's a specific kind of dictatorship that varies enough from your generic dictatorships that I'm going to set it aside. We've got sort of oligarchical states. I don't know how to put something like Russia, where there's elements of democracy, there's small elements of fascism.
But ultimately, it's just a group of strong men.
It's very capitalistic. We have democracies, or what they call democracies and republics, and there's a few other forms. But, essentially, we've discarded monarchy. Even the monarchies that are left are essentially republics, England being the most extreme example, where the monarch is ceremonial entirely. There's other monarchies in the Middle East where the monarch still rules, but has to rule with a parliament and some amount of election. And I think we're going to run into the shortcomings of democracy over the next couple of centuries. I should probably save this all for forecast, but
you should.
I think we're going to get over this idea that we champion republicanism and democracy, and I don't mean those in party lines. I mean I mean them in the governmental definition. We're going to get over that as a reaction to monarchy, which is essentially what it is. This is the best system we've had to date, and it is better than the absolutist monarchs that we revolted against in the 1600s and 1700s. And we're starting to run through these kind of revolutions, and maybe Egypt will be another example of democracy springing up from the people. But way down the road, we're going to realize the shortcomings of that and realize where it doesn't work and where it actually gives too much power to small groups of people, and where it ends up actually giving too much power to the populace. I don't know what that... I'm always trying to figure out, like, what kind of government would that be?
Neo-feudalism.
You joke, but I'd say even before feudalism to more of a tribal organization. I think it might start borrowing, because the reason we have monarchy is because tribes of people realized that you needed one person to make the calls. You see this in corporate America. Corporate America is not a democracy. Maybe that's where we get our model from. You have a single person who makes the calls, but is also answerable to stockholders and to employees. And in tribal organization, you had one chief that made the calls. Where I think monarchy went wrong was when it became hereditary. And they said, you know what? He made a great chief. Let's have his son be a chief. He got all sentimental about it.
Well, I think part of the hereditary was the benefits of marrying your offspring and combining neighboring kingdoms without necessarily having to shed blood all the time, instead of just going to war. Like, hey, you know what? we can reach an agreement. Let's seal the deal. I'll have my kid marry your kid. And since they're all both related to us, they're kind of in charge anyway. And, you know, I mean, I think that was just, you know, a mechanism to allow a power to kind of not only to be retained within a group of people, but to allow them to experiment or at least try different forms of diplomacy with other tribes. I don't know. I still like neo-feudalism because I think it sounds very futuristic.
Yeah. It does make a good sci-fi book.
What would you call it?
Though? I think if we went back, one of the things that happened with tribalism that led later to feudalism and absolutist monarchies and rule by divine right and all of that was a lack of experience and education to foresee how freedoms and rights and privileges would be lost by centering too much power in one person. And that is the revolution of democracy that has happened over the past couple of centuries. And I think what will happen next would be an identification of where current democratic republics take away freedoms and privileges while remaining democratic republics, and maybe a return to figure saying, you know what? We actually have learned from this. What if we take the best elements of a chieftain society, but with technology, we can actually blow this up in large areas over the world. I'm not saying this is the answer or what I'm describing is, you know, I'm certainly not saying we should go back to feudalism or tribalism or monarchy necessarily, but I think we start borrowing ideas from that and experimenting, like you're saying, with more knowledge of history and what the pitfalls are that we can avoid. But the reason I think that this is important is that the goal should be quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget that. We forget that in economics when we let money be a substitute for quality of life and it isn't always one-to-one. And we forget it in politics when we say things like democracy and freedom should be the goal when actually quality of life should be the goal.
Yeah. And of course, you know, things like quality of life, I mean, are very important, but it's also how people define them, right? Because mm-hmm. various people have ideas of what a quality of life or a quality life is. And I don't know. We might be on the verge of you know, literally separating back down to not city states, but just smaller entities. I mean, there's just so many people, you know, in human history and, you know, trying to govern over, I mean, even 300 million plus in this country. I mean, it's progressively gotten more. And I think part of that, you know, as part of the issues we see with political parties these days is I think some of it's related just to the sheer number of people that need to be governed. And, you know, maybe we break down, you know, government into more bite-sized or more easy to handle groups. And then everyone meets one year to kind of duke it out. You know, maybe not physically, maybe it'll be kind of a talent show like American Idol or something. And, you know, whoever gets to win that gets to make 12 changes for the next 4 years.
I'm liking where you're going with that. I wish we could go forever, but we should probably get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for watching. If you'd like to make your comments on what you think should happen in the world, go to sobriety.com/EMW and post your comments. We read them all. We don't always read all of them on the show, but we do try to work them in when they make sense, and we love to read what you have to think there on the blog. So check it out. Thanks, Roger.
All right. Thank you for having – wait, it's my show. Our show. I'm always happy to be here, Tom.
Sobriety.com/EMW is the website. Thanks to Jammer B for running the board here during the live stream at Twit. Thanks to Leo for letting us do it on the Twit Network. And thanks to you for watching or listening. We will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.